for F. King Alexander, former president of Oregon State University. And can we get a start off with a staff report?
All right, so 6401, I believe, is that Sean O'Day as well? Who's ending with 6401?
Oh, somebody else.
I'm not on a phone, I'm just on the computer.
Okay. So I don't know who the 6401 is.
Unknown participant is now exiting.
Okay. So disembodied. So I texted and I'm waiting for a response.
For the person who's going to join us?
Mm-hmm.
For this?
The attorney. That's
good. The attorney? Yeah, mm-hmm. Thank you.
My apologies. I thought we had, I signed him up there before we initially started.
Okay.
We could do another case.
Well, we could do other ones. Yeah. Waiting, I guess.
Since we're in exec session, we'll
start with. Okay, commissioners, we are going to move to case number 35 in your meeting book, the case of Karen Labonte.
I think it's Labonte.
Labonte, Public Works Director for City of Cannon Beach.
So this one, I don't know who that is. They're trying to get back in, so that could be.
Could be her.
The individual that we have to ask. So I'll admit them, and then we can ask who that is.
Hello.
Unknown participant is now joining.
6401.
Yeah, the phone number with ending 6401. Can you state your name?
Unknown participant is now exiting.
Sorry.
Technology is beautiful.
That's not who you're texting, right?
I'm texting the attorney again.
Oh, but it's not 6401.
No. No. It's 5551.
Chair, I'm sorry. I lost the thread. Are we on 35 or are we on the King Alexander matter?
We are going
page 285.
Assuming we're comfortable with starting with number 35, page 285 in your book, Karen Labonte.
Thank you. Excuse me, Chair Mason, Commissioners. My name is Lisa Kristen. I'm an investigator with the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. The matter before you at page 285, item number 35 in your meeting book, is Karen Labonte, case number 21020ELC. Ms. Labonte is the Public Works Director of the City of Cannon Beach. The complaint was filed by a citizen of Cannon Beach alleging that respondent might have attempted to use her position to obtain financial gain for a business with which she is associated, and also may have failed to declare a conflict of interest when the city contracted with the business for services. Ms. Labonte and her husband own a graphic design company in Cannon Beach. In the spring of 2020, the city purchased signs from the business to deal with situations created by the pandemic, including closure signs and mask signs placed around the city of Cannon Beach. Although the city manager engaged in actually procuring the signs from the company and purchasing the same, there does not appear to be any violation of ORS 2440401. Ms. Labonte may have failed to properly declare a conflict of interest. ORS 244121C requires an appointed official, such as the respondent, to notify their supervisor in writing about any actual or potential conflict and also to request that the supervisor dispose of the conflict. Neither of those steps appear to have been taken in relation to the possible actual conflict existing on the facts currently before the commission. The preliminary review report is in your meeting book with a recommendation to move the matter to investigation on the issue of the possible conflict of interest. Thank you.
Thank you for that. And we do not have Ms. Labonte with us. Do we have any questions from commissioners for our investigator?
Mr. Chair, I would just ask quickly, if I missed this when you were speaking, Ms. Kristen, I apologize. It appears to me that the bottom line recommendation you make is at the bottom of page 298 and the top of 299. there not being objective belief that their individual violated use of office, but that she did violate conflict of interest. Is that the conclusion, I presume?
Correct. Thank you for that. Ms. Labonte is represented by counsel, and I've had extensive talks and information provided by counsel that there had been somewhat of a wall erected around this business because they did use this business quite frequently for signage through Cannon Beach. Because of that, we didn't believe that there was enough information to support a finding that there, or even an investigation on the use of office. However, there was never a declaration of this conflict, and again, she did co-own the business with her husband, so we believe that did warrant investigation. So you're absolutely correct. One, not the other.
Mr. Chair, one further follow-up. With all due respect to your comment, there doesn't appear to be, to me, to be much more to investigate in light of what you already know. So this may ask you to presume something that you are not appropriate to presume, but we would likely be moving to some kind of a settlement if we move to investigation. Is that a fair proposition or not?
Correct. I mean, at the end of the day, it is the commission's decision to make, but we would probably be recommending some type of education on this simply because, in all honesty, it appears to be an oversight. Hmm.
Thank you, Ms. Kristen.
Thank you.
Commissioner Hollister.
Thank you, Chair. So a question for staff. I'm in the attorney's letter, Ms. Monson's letter, on page 4, it states that the city manager and director Levon had already discussed the existence of the conflict, common knowledge, and they put into action a standing workaround procedure. And so I guess my question is, has it been our sort of position that it's not permissible under the rules to sort of declare a standing conflict of interest that you have to do it on each occasion that it might arise? I'm trying to get my head around this idea because it looks like they tried to have some sort of a standing sort of statement that the conflict existed, and I just want to confirm that's not something that meets the requirement of the rule.
Thank you for the question. There were two emails and a oral conversation with a prior boss at a time when Ms. Labonte was actually not in the position of Public Works Director. When she was an employee, she had a brief conversation with a former boss who's no longer with Cannon Beach. And then there were two emails in which she noted something along the lines of, the specifics I believe are in the report, but that her husband owned this business and that was it. What's required under the statute is that there be a written notification to the supervisor on each occasion when the conflict appears, and that the supervisor be asked to provide and does provide direction on how to address the conflict. Those two elements are missing here because, again, what was at issue were in the complaint were the signs that related to the pandemic. So last spring, 2020, there were two sets of signs ordered and purchased from this Cannon Beach Design Company. And at no time during that interaction, if you will, was there a notification in writing to a supervisor, nor was there a request for the supervisor to, again, advise Ms. Labonte how to approach the conflict and how to address the conflict.
So I have a...
Yeah.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Just for an additional, Commissioner Hollister, I also believe that what you said earlier is true, that the statute requires declaration at each occasion. However, I think a public body can set up a declaration like they tried to do here, but I still think it's the public official's responsibility to kind of activate that declaration. In other words, they need to tell them, it's like, okay, again, we're ordering signs for my company. Let's go back to that declaration. So I think there is kind of a way of doing that, but there is a responsibility on each occasion to declare the conflict of interest. Again, I think this is going to be served best by education for the city and for Ms. Labonte. But so I think there is a kind of a way of doing it, but I still think that needs to be, at least me as an employee, I would have it on the record each time it came up that declaration that I have out there, it's the same conflict that I'm talking about, but, here's another occasion that we want to buy signs from the company that I co-own. So...
Thank you for that, Executive Director. I just note from a practical perspective, this could be a sticky area for public officials who are trying to comply to fall into, and so I just would like to flag it for maybe
future inclusion in training materials.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Hollister. That's a great point. I appreciate that input. Commissioner Sosa?
Yes, thank you, Chair. So there is some reference in the materials to the fact that Director Levant and the city manager had already discussed the existence of the conflict. Were we able to confirm that those discussions took place?
Yes, I did receive an email, several emails actually, from Mr. St. Denis, who is the city manager, and he indicated essentially that his belief at that time was that this conflict had been addressed in a prior situation. And again, that was referencing back to a conversation she had when she was first employed by the city in a different position. And he also believed that the, you know, again, the wall they put around the procurement would be also addressing the conflict of interest when, again, there's two separate issues here, really. Because in point of fact is that what happened here is Mr. St. Denis asked Ms. Labonte flat out, can you check and see if your company can make these signs for us? And it was after that that the billing, the procurement, the actual possession of the signs was done by other people in accordance with their, you know, what they're calling the workaround. But at no point was there an announced, or excuse me, a written statement of the conflict or in a, you know, a request to address the conflict. When, again, what happened was she was asked to go to her company and find out whether or not they could do these signs, how much they would charge, whether they had the equipment, et cetera. So again, we were looking at it first as a use of office on that. When they assured us that, you know, the, again, the billing, the pricing, everything was done separately and apart from her, we realized that there really hadn't been. I think they were all operating, my opinion is they were operating on the presumption that there had been a written declaration of conflict, and actually that had not happened. Nor, again, had there been a request by the from the supervisor to address the conflict in a certain way and again, let everybody know that that's how they would be operating. So.
And in looking at the statute, it says that an actual conflict occurs when a public official takes any action or makes any decision or recommendation. So in this case, I think what we're focused on then is any action that she took, and that action was to obtain the information that her supervisor told her to obtain from her own company?
Correct. That's exactly right. There was a you know, again, a workaround put in place, but to be honest, the workaround was not followed on either of the occasions that were before us right now, which again led us to examine the conflict issue and whether or not there had been proper notification. But exactly, there was action taken.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other discussion from commissioners or questions for the investigator? Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, hearing none, a quick little comment. I would appreciate the work of our staff, in particular in this regard, because it's been clarified for me. That said, I will move approval of the staff recommendation to investigate possible violations of ORS 244.120(1) involving Ms. Karen Labonte, Public Works Director for the City of Cannon Beach.
Thank you, Commissioner Fiscom. Any discussion on the motion? Commissioner Sosa. And then Commissioner
O'Shea. I struggle with this one because I understand kind of the nature of what was going on here. They were in the middle of a crisis. Brought on by the pandemic. They were trying to act quickly. It seemed like everybody knew the situation. They knew she was involved. They tried to be scrupulous in adhering to this. The supervisor says, well, I only had her obtain information. She made no decisions on this. So, I continue to struggle because it looks like they were making a good faith effort. It technically didn't qualify, but obviously, the purpose of these statutes is to put people on notice when there is conflict, and it sounds like everybody knew it. They just didn't address it in precisely the way they should have because they were under the mistaken belief that they had. So I'm not really sure what to do with this one, but I'm happy to hear from my fellow commissioners.
Thank you, Commissioner Sosa. Commissioner O'Day?
Great, thank you, Mr. Chair. Will said, Mr. Sosa, I share the same concern, and I don't think I could have articulated it as well as you just did, so thanks for that. I think, a question for staff in the deliberation part of our proceeding here. So when an employee has a conflict, as opposed to a member of an elected body or an appointed body, What does the statute require that employee to do with that conflict?
The statute requires them to declare that in writing to their appointing authority, which is usually their supervisor.
And ask the supervisor for direction on how to handle the conflict. So it's like a two-prong approach to it, if it's an appointed official rather than an elected official.
So in this case, there was no written notice to the supervisor, but presumably, had there been, I think we know how that supervisor would have reacted, would have said, okay, thank you, can you please check with your company and see if they can deliver these signs, and then we'll follow the existing protocol. And if that were the case, as I think we can safely assume it would have been, given that the supervisor was aware that this employee had a company that could be doing business with the city, that's implied and inherent in the supervisor's request to the employee to go check with her company to purchase, you know, these signs. Would there be a violation, or would there be anything to act on if that was the supervisor's direction to the employee after submitting a written notification?
Not as far as a conflict of interest goes, no.
So I think that's the issue for me, is that although technically the writing is required, there was effective notice as demonstrated by the supervisor's own request, and I think we can infer from that how the supervisor would have handled this. So personally, I'm okay with this moving to an investigation, but I'm not sure, you know, ultimately, you know, that there would be a violation here. I would want to think about it, and I would certainly want to hear from the parties about it. So that's where I am on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner O'Day. Any other commissioners?
Mr. Chair, pursuant to Commissioner Sosa's and Commissioner O'Day's comments, I would be happy to withdraw the motion if they have a substitute motion. At the same time, I think what we have here is what struck me earlier, which is a technical violation without it's not a huge one. If we had the ability to, at this moment, send a letter of education along with a dismissal, I'd be happy to do that. But usually, as I understand it, we need to move to an investigation before taking that action, which is the intent, at least expressed by our staff. So I guess I'd let the motion stand unless anybody wants to argue with it. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Fiskum. And I think Commissioner Sosa makes some really valid points. And, I think the appropriate move at this point is to move to investigation. I think that we can always dismiss if it looks like, you know, it is more of a, you know, a simple or petty violation, in my opinion, based on it. I got the impression that she thought that she had given went through the right protocols, but obviously there's some technical violations from what the investigator said. So any other commissioners before we are at least on the motion? Seeing none, a roll call vote.
Commissioner Edwards?
Aye.
Commissioner Fiskum?
Aye.
Commissioner Hollister?
Aye.
Commissioner Lindsay? Commissioner Lindsay?
Aye. Sorry, technical difficulties here.
Commissioner O'Day?
Story of 2021.
Aye. Commissioner Sortoon?
Yeah, 2021.
Aye.
Commissioner Sosa?
Nay.
Commissioner Starr?
Aye.
Chair Mason?
Aye.
Motion passes 8-1.
Thank you. And do we have somebody? Okay, so we'll go back to number 51 in the case of F. King Alexander, former president of Oregon State University. And can we get a staff report?
Sure. Make sure that I'm. Yep. Hi, Ms. Angeli.
Hello.
Chair Mason, commissioners. My name is Diane Gould, commission staff. And this is number 51 in your meeting books, page 427. And a complaint was received alleging that F. King Alexander, while president of Oregon State University, may have violated Oregon ethics law by using the Oregon State attorney to to respond on his behalf to an investigation into events that occurred prior to his tenure at OSU. Dr. Alexander was president of Louisiana State University prior to working at OSU. Louisiana State hired a law firm to conduct an investigation into the mishandling of sexual misconduct complaints by the university during the period of Dr. Alexander's tenure as president there. Information during preliminary review indicates that the investigators contacted the OSU attorney concerning setting up an interview with Dr. Alexander, and the OSU counsel responded on Dr. Alexander's behalf that he preferred to respond to written questions rather than an interview, and that the investigators should send those questions to the counsel. Dr. Alexander's response to those questions was provided to the commission staff by Oregon State University. Dr. Alexander, through his attorney, responded to this complaint and explained that Dr. Alexander did not direct the OSU counsel to act on his behalf with the LSU hired investigators. The OSU attorney never advised Dr. Alexander that he may be in danger of violating Oregon ethics laws by not retaining private counsel concerning these LSU matters, and that the investigation was broader than the events during Dr. Alexander's tenure at LSU, so it was appropriate for OSU counsel to be involved. There appears to be cause to believe that a violation of the conflict of interest and prohibited use of office provisions may have occurred, and that further investigation is warranted. The preliminary review report is in your meeting books with a recommendation to move to investigation. And Dr. Alexander's attorney, Ms. Courtney Angeli, provided news articles concerning Dr. Alexander for the commissioners to consider today, and they were emailed to you yesterday. Ms. Angeli is present and would like to address the commission.
Thank you for that. Ms. Angeli, this is your opportunity to share with the commission. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. How's my sound? Can y'all hear me?
Great.
Yeah, it's good.
Okay, super. So, good morning, and first I want to thank you for your important work ensuring ethical accountability in Oregon. Dr. Alexander, appreciate your role and your time today hearing our perspective on Investigator Gould's preliminary findings. So, as you just heard from the charge, an individual outside the university filed this complaint, apparently just because he read an article in USA Today, and he concluded, based on that article, that Dr. Alexander, who was then president of Oregon State, must have received personal legal advice from Oregon State University's in-house counsel connected to this investigation that Louisiana State was conducting. Now, Rebecca Ghost is Oregon State University's general counsel. And the complainant's particular concern seems to have stemmed from a single sentence in this USA Today article that stated, quote, Oregon State's general counsel responded to LSU on Alexander's behalf and said he, referencing Dr. Alexander, would only take written questions. Now, the sentence in the article doesn't suggest that Ms. Ghost gave Dr. Alexander legal advice. Transmitting questions and answers doesn't amount to legal advice. Ms. Ghost was simply participating in an information flow for the benefit of her own client, which was OSU, to advise OSU of potential implications of the investigation. So as part of that, the commission should understand as a preliminary matter that this investigation was a public and not in any way a private or personal matter to Dr. Alexander. It was reasonable for OSU's general counsel to be at the center of these communications. Dr. Alexander received no private personal benefit from her involvement, and there's no indication in the record that he did. And for that reason, you should find no cause to continue this investigation. There simply is no substantial evidence that a potential violation occurred. So the public nature of the LSU investigation is obvious from the public statements that the Hush-Blackwell report ultimately elicited from elected officials in Oregon. On March 18th, and this is part of the media reports that I provided yesterday, Oregon Governor Kate Brown publicly called on the OSU Board of Trustees to fire Dr. Alexander if it found that he did not uphold his ethical and legal responsibilities to protect students while he was at LSU. That's reported in the Statesman Journal story. And legislator Sarah Gelzer made a similar statement. These statements to the media made plain that this investigation that LSU was conducting was just a matter of public concern. These statements illustrate why OSU's general counsel would have seen this matter as something that she needed to be at the center of communications so she could advise her client, which was not Dr. Alexander, but OSU, of its potential legal consequences. And the commission should conclude that Dr. Alexander would seek to or obtain any personal benefit from her facilitating communications between him and LSU. As I stated in my initial letter, the questions and answers came in through Ms. Dose, and it's not surprising they went out through Ms. Dose. It's also indisputable, and again, this is where the media reports show this, that there was a direct connection between the Hush Blackwell report and Dr. Alexander's subsequent resignation. The link between that investigation and his departure from OSU shows this was a matter of public concern and a matter in which Ms. Dose's participation just in the communication chain made sense. One media outlet, Saturday Down South, that's one of the articles I provided, described this connection in its headline, stating, F. King Alexander resigns at Oregon State following the release of the Hush Blackwell report at LSU. If this situation had been some exclusively private matter, Dr. Alexander wouldn't have felt compelled to resign from OSU. From it, there wouldn't have been the public outcry that I'm sure you all just saw in the general media about this. And in the same vein, Sam Carlin tweeted, as quoted in that article that I just referenced, F. King Alexander is out as president of Oregon State University amid mounting scrutiny of his mishandling of sexual misconduct at LSU, the OSU board says. So I want to talk a little bit about the factual background because the details here are important. They demonstrate why no further investigation is necessary. Those details show that Dr. Alexander didn't use his position to obtain any sort of financial gain. I'm not going to rehash the arguments in our initial position statement, but what I want to do is respond to some of the factual questions that Ms. Gould's preliminary report raises because I think they're teed up essentially as reasons why you need to investigate further, but they just don't show that at all. So the facts about the Hush Blackwell investigation are these. First of all, Louisiana State's investigator never directly approached Dr. Alexander directly relating to its investigation. That old investigation yielded the Hush Blackwell report. Hush Blackwell was just the name of the law firm that was conducting this on behalf of LSU. Now, at all times in its communications, Hush Blackwell characterized this investigation and its purpose broadly so that Ms. Ghost, OSU's general counsel, plainly determined it was appropriate for her to participate in these communications, and Dr. Alexander likewise was not surprised by her facilitating these discussions. The broadness of how LSU was teeing this up explains the reference in the USA Today article that prompted this individual to make the complaint. And that reference shows she was communicating with Hush Blackwell about its questions for Dr. Alexander. But it's also clear that she determined she didn't have a conflict of interest in facilitating communications between LSU's law firm and Dr. Alexander. And Dr. Alexander relied on that. She never said, hey, I've got a conflict, hey, you need to get a private attorney in connection with this back and forth about their factual question. It was also pretty clear, I think to everybody, that this investigation was a matter of public interest. So in her role as general counsel with Oregon State as her client, she had an interest in knowing what Oregon State University's president was saying about his knowledge of these events. And it was normal for her to want to stay informed about the role of him in the investigation for OSU's own purposes. Oregon State had an interest in knowing those facts for purposes of its own media announcements, as well as for its communications with its board of trustees, faculty, and Oregon public. So as a reminder, the original email inquiry came from a guy named Mr. Schneider at Hush Blackwell, an attorney at Hush Blackwell, on February 20th, 2021, and that was directed solely to the attention of Ms. Gopes. And in that email, he described himself as an interviewer and said he was working on a, quote, broad review of LSU's processes and policies in a comparative light with other, quote, peer institution best practices. From his email, Investigator Gould has drawn several unwarranted inferences, but this submission should really look beyond this sort of these speculative inferences that she's drawn and should find that none of her inferences compel a continued investigation. First, she says this email raises a question of whether Ms. Ghost had prior knowledge about the interview request, because she says the email chain contains a reference to Ms. Ghost having spoken to LSU's general counsel's office, and that's on page 10 of her report. From this reference, Ms. Gould speculates that there may have been prior communication about Hush Blackwell's request between the OSU counsel and the LSU counsel, and between OSU counsel and respondent at a minimum. So she's saying, look, I can tell from this email chain that there must have been some prior communication, at least between Ms. Ghost and LSU's general counsel. And so I want to speak to this unsupported speculation as it relates to Dr. Alexander. So to be clear, Dr. Alexander had no prior communication with LSU about this investigation, and there's no indication that he did in the record. There's simply no evidence of such a thing. It's entirely unwarranted, and it's not the sort of objective evidence that provides cause to continue an investigation. Now, as for whether prior communication occurred between the general counsel's office at OSU and LSU, you should accept that if it did, that's normal and commonplace. When a president moves to a new university, the institutions need to communicate about transitional matters of all sorts. Usually, university presidents are, you know, in some way involved in litigation in both places, and their general counsel's offices need to communicate. But even assuming that Ms. Ghost and the general counsel at LSU had discussed LSU's intended investigation, there's no evidence Dr. Alexander had any knowledge of the substance or fact of any such communications. And if he did, that nevertheless doesn't show Dr. Alexander seeking any personal gain. As a matter of fact, Dr. Alexander simply doesn't know if such a communication was initiated by LSU or OSU, how it came up. Presumably it was incidental to some other communications, but he doesn't have any information and knew nothing about it. He has no recollection whatsoever of taking any action that would have prompted or spurred any communication between Ms. Ghost and LSU's general counsel about LSU's investigation, and there's no record of such a thing. So in other words, even if you accept the premise of Investigator Gould that prior communications occurred about this investigation between the general counsel's office of these two universities, that doesn't in any way show that Dr. Alexander provoked that communication, sought legal advice relating to the investigation, nor does it evidence any effort by Dr. Alexander to obtain a personal benefit. You should also note that whatever communications may have occurred between OSU and LSU, nothing about that prompted Ms. Ghost to advise Dr. Alexander that he needed to consult with a personal attorney about the investigation. And importantly, as a licensed attorney, Ms. Ghost had an ethical obligation to advise Dr. Alexander if she felt he was coming to him for advice and she had a conflict of interest in advising him and OSU. And there's nothing here that evidences anything except that she's a communication intermediary in a non-legal sense. She never made such caution to Dr. Alexander of, hey, I can't provide you advice about the fact of the investigation. So those are the facts, and I want to turn to the legal issues here. Not the things that I stated in the prior letter, which I hope you're able to read, but the legal issues as I see them in light of Investigator Gould's report. So, as I said before, the LSU investigation was never an exclusively private matter. It was plainly one of public interest and significant relevant to OSU. And so it was entirely predictable that Ms. Dose would seek to be involved in communications between LSU and OSU. That involvement, being in a communication chain, particularly with a third party, does not constitute legal advice. So Ms. Gould has made the frankly confounding determination that the LSU investigation was a private legal matter when it was plainly one of public concern. So as explained in our letter response, there can be no question that that Hush Blackwell was broadly characterizing this investigation as a peer-to-peer institutional analysis from the start. And Ms. Gould's report contends that after these questions, these are the questions that are in your materials PR number 4, and that was submitted by OSU. The report contends that after these questions were forwarded to the OSU Council for Respondent, there was no illusion that the questions concerned anything other than respondents' tenure as president of LSU. So we disagree with Ms. Gould's inference that the questions concerned a private legal matter solely because those questions asked about LSU's practices and Dr. Alexander's understanding of LSU's prior handling of Title IX matters. So first, as I'll explain momentarily, this was not a legal matter in Dr. Alexander's mind. He was simply a witness to an investigation that he didn't understand to be particularly focused on him. He didn't seek advice about how to respond from Ms. Gose. He wrote up his own answers to these questions. The Hush Blackwell investigation to him concerned a matter of public interest where he was just a potentially relevant witness, and he sought to be responsive in that capacity, and he understood that he was communicating to LSU's attorney through Oregon State University because that's how those questions came in. And media headlines that I cited before show that Dr. Alexander's interpretation of the investigation as a public matter, not private, not personal to him, that makes sense. And that's all reflected in the record of these just sample articles that I provided. And as a reminder, and now I'm referencing the Reveille article that I included in my letter yesterday, those news reports show that LSU's investigation was kicked off by a November 16, 2020 USA Today article that focused on what's going on in LSU's athletic department, and it accused LSU, not Dr. Alexander, of mishandling sexual assault cases. That led LSU to hire a law firm to investigate its Title IX office and the LSU Police Department. Dr. Alexander was a witness because he was present during some of the time in question. And nothing about the questions issued, and you can look at them, suggested he was a target or that he faced some personal liability. Again, he just thought, well, I'm a relevant witness to this. And you know this is a public matter because, as indicated in that Reveille article, even before Mr. Schneider had reached out to Ms. Gose, media reports show that Hush Blackwell was asking to interview any LSU student who was willing to share their perspective. It was a really broad inquiry. The idea that it was somehow private to Dr. Alexander or personal to him is utterly insupportable. And that assumption is the grounding for Ms. Gould's conclusion that there's some personal gain here and that you all need to do more digging. That's not the case. Now, importantly, when it became clear several weeks after the communications that are relevant to the complaint at issue here, it became clear that LSU's investigation might impact Dr. Alexander's employment. And at that point, Ms. Goes advised him, hey, you need separate counsel. I'm representing the university. I can't talk to you about this. And that was around March 12, 2021. That was several weeks after the Schneider email. And at that point, Dr. Alexander retained me to communicate with Ms. Ghost on his behalf about those legal matters personal to him. At that point, he did have personal legal concerns, specifically regard to his employment at OSU, and he rightly sought private counsel. Now, Dr. Alexander did not receive any financial gain from the fact that Ms. Ghost transmitted these communications, the Q&A, to Hush Blackwell. She didn't provide any legal advice to Dr. Alexander, and he didn't request any from her. He didn't use his position to get something of value. He didn't get anything of value by virtue of her transmitting through email his answers to these questions. He didn't receive any legal services by virtue of her simply being an intermediary in communications that had come in through her office. And so there's simply no need to investigate, quote, and this is from the report, what legal services Dr. Alexander obtained from OSU, which is the question that Ms. Gould has cited to justify you continuing an investigation here. You have in the record these questions, and Dr. Alexander wrote those answers himself. They're factual matters, only he could write them. And to be clear, Ms. Ghost did not complete these questions and answers for Dr. Alexander. She didn't offer him legal advice as to how he might go about answering them, and he didn't request any. He regarded them as factual questions seeking factual information. You'll see from his answers that he gave straightforward answers that they're non-defensive. There's no sort of legalistic response on the face of this document. The answers he submitted contain no legal objections. Continuing this investigation to dig into, quote, what legal advice Ms. Ghost provided would yield only one answer, and that's none. There's no cause to continue this investigation. Although Ms. Ghost provided some feedback after reviewing the answers for the benefit of OSU, that didn't help Dr. Alexander. A university's general counsel plainly anticipates that any report about how its president handled Title IX issues at a prior university, that could have consequences and potential publicity for Oregon State. It did. And Ms. Ghost apparently and rightly felt she needed to know, hey, what's going on here? And sought to understand and evaluate the potential implications, but that would have been presumptively for OSU's benefit. Allowing Ms. Ghost to have visibility into those communications was not Dr. Alexander receiving legal advice, it was simply him providing a courtesy that any competent university president would offer his organization's general counsel. And the fact that Ms. Ghost is a lawyer who is in the communication loop doesn't mean she was providing legal advice. It simply means she's keeping an eye out for issues that might have legal consequences for her own client, which is OSU. And to be clear, Dr. Alexander made no request for legal advice from her. And nothing about the USA Today article that prompted this complaint suggests that he was requesting legal advice. There would have to be some specific substantial evidence of that having occurred for this commission to conclude that he may have used his position for pecuniary gain. And given his years of experience in a university setting, it's reasonable to expect that he understood the importance of allowing Ms. Goes access to review and transmit these communications so that she knew what was going on, so she could advise OSU. Ms. Gould's preliminary investigation is plainly done in good faith, but it shows just a short-sightedness and a limited understanding about the role of a university general counsel. A general counsel has a broad duty to an organization to advise it, and that means that she needs to stay on top of issues that have potential implications for it. From the start, LSU made clear it was undertaking a broad and comparative review. It directed its inquiries through Ms. Goes, likely because LSU certainly realized that given Dr. Alexander's role as president, the LSU investigation could have consequences for Oregon State. And Ms. Goes most certainly realized that too. But at the stage of the inquiry that's covered by the complaint that you all are evaluating, Ms. Goes didn't tell Dr. Alexander, and he didn't believe there was some conflict of interest here, and that personal legal advice to him was needed. She wasn't providing him with legal advice. There's also a reference in here I want to briefly touch on. Ms. Gould erroneously concluded that Dr. Alexander did not notify the Board of Trustees of what she says was a conflict of interest and thereby violated the ethics statutes. Now, it's true that Dr. Alexander did not notify the board that he had a conflict of interest when he got the questions from Hush Blackwell, because, as I've explained, he didn't perceive there as being any conflict of interest. He simply perceived himself as being a witness to an investigation that LSU was conducting, and he was allowing OSU's own counsel insight into what was being communicated. Now, once the LSU report was set to issue, Dr. Alexander did apprise the board of his role as a witness in that investigation, and on March 5th, he notified the board that the report would issue, but that he didn't know what was in it. That communication is subject to the attorney-client privilege that's held by Oregon State, but there's no evidence in the record to contradict this. So you all should simply not find there's cause to undertake any further investigation. ORS 244.260 subpart 9 defines cause as being a substantial objective basis for believing that an offense or violation may have been committed and the person to be investigated may have committed an offense or violation. Here, there is simply no evidence beyond utter speculation that's unfounded given the context that Dr. Alexander sought to or did use his position for personal gain. All that happened is Ms. Ghost was part of a communication chain between LSU and its investigation and Dr. Alexander, who was a witness in that process and who was serving as OSU's president. And that was normal, it was a normal function for her given the broad duties of the university's general counsel and the fact that LSU had directed those questions to her. If this commission finds this chain of events to be a violation, there will be simply no end to the complaints and investigations that will follow entirely needlessly because people in general counsel positions, such as Ms. Ghost, participate in these kinds of communications all the time, and there's nothing improper about it. Dr. Alexander, as I'm sure you all are aware from the very extensive publicity, has moved on from Oregon and is now in his private life. He had a decades-long academic reputation and involvement in public universities, and that has been destroyed by this matter. The actions of the governor with the public comment that I talked about at the outset, Oregon State University and the Oregon State University Board of Trustees are direct causes in this. And the governor and the Board of Trustees and OSU are still very much in the public eye. And further investigation into this baseless complaint is only going to unleash more media frenzy and cause unnecessary political and legal troubles for everyone discussed herein, and that will truly be over nothing. I appreciate your time today, and I am requesting to follow up my comments with a written record to the commission, reiterating some of the points that I've made to be entered into the case record for your further consideration. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you all may have.
Thank you, Ms. Angelie. We appreciate that presentation. We're going to open this up first to the commissioners for questions for staff, and then they will have an opportunity to ask you any questions with regards to your presentation. We'll start off with Commissioner Sosa.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Ms. Gould, have you had an opportunity to speak to Ms. Ghost about this matter?
No, I have not.
So you haven't been able to substantiate the scope of her conversations with Dr. Alexander?
No, that's why I recommended going to investigation.
Thank you.
Commissioner Hollister.
Thank you. I guess I just want to sort of get the staff's thinking on some of these issues raised by Ms. Angeli. And you'll have to excuse me if I get a little hyper-technical here. So in terms of whether or not Ms. Ghost was providing legal advice to Dr. Alexander, my understanding of the standard or that the Supreme Court's definition of whether or not legal services are being provided was articulated in the case of Oregon State Bar versus Security Escrows, Inc. at 233 Oregon 80, the 1962 case. And there the court held that the practice of law includes the drafting or selection of documents and the giving of advice in regard thereto. Any time an informed or trained discretion must be exercised in the selection or drafting of a document to meet the needs of a person being served. So given that definition, I'm wondering whether or not Ms. Ghost, whether or not you found she actually reviewed documents and exercised individualized discretion on behalf of Dr. Alexander.
No. As I just answered, I haven't spoken to Ms. Ghost. I know that she had spoken to President Alexander, according to her email, that she says, we understand. Okay, where does she say?
And I guess I'm wondering if there's any written evidence that she reviewed the responses to the questions provided.
No, I haven't. No, I just have his responses on a piece of paper that's headed King Alexander, March 1st, response to Hush Blackwell questions, sent February 24th. And then the 13 questions.
So I guess I would want to know if the commission votes to continue with the investigation, I'd be curious to see the answer to that. And then, you know, with respect to whether or not Dr. Alexander, you know, was represented by Ms. Ghost in this inquiry, it seems to me that the answer has to be yes, based on the test articulated in In re Widener by the Oregon Supreme Court. And I'm looking at that case, which is at 310 Oregon 757. It's a 1990 decision. A reasonable expectation of the existence of attorney-client relationship exists when the putative client has a subjective uncommunicated intention or expectation of representation accompanied by evidence of objective facts on which a reasonable person would rely. And I mean, just looking at the email exchange between Ms. Ghost and Ms. Schneider, I guess I'm having a hard time believing that there wasn't such an attorney-client relationship, you know, that existed in, between Dr. Alexander and Ms. Ghost. So, I mean, is that your understanding, Investigator Gold?
I couldn't hear the last part, that there wasn't an attorney-client.
No, there was.
There was. It seemed like it from her response where she says, President Alexander is happy to help, but would prefer to provide written answers to questions. So she seems to be representing his communications back to these investigators there.
Right. Okay. That's helpful. And then just one final question for you, Investigator Gold. Thanks for your patience with me today. So Ms. Angeli mentioned that Ms. Gold would have had an obligation to notify Dr. Alexander that there might have been an adversity between him and the university. And I believe that her reference is to Rule of Professional Conduct 1.13F, which does provide for such a notification. But is it your understanding that an attorney's violation of the Rules of Professional Conduct under the Chapter 244 wouldn't somehow excuse the public official's failure to declare a conflict of interest. Is that correct?
Yes. Oh, are you talking to me or the attorney?
No.
Okay.
I'm talking to
you. Okay,
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yes, my understanding is that the public official, the responsibility is on the public official to be aware of the ethics laws and to properly comply. It's not the staff of the university or even the legal counsel.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying those matters for me, Investigator Gold. I appreciate your work on this.
May I speak to that?
This is just for commissioners at this moment, Ms. Angeli, but we can definitely get back to you in just one moment. I think Commissioner O'Day, you had your hand up, and then Commissioner Fiscom.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate it. You know, these cases are always difficult. I find when a matter, as Ms. Angeli noted, like this one, is one of public interest, but also of a private interest. It often puts that general counsel in a tough spot, because I think those of us who've ever served a public body knows, and frankly, we wrestle with this issue at this commission, not as commissioners, but we see regularly public officials appearing before us, and perhaps their general counsel is there advocating on their behalf, or it could be a hired attorney who's hired by the city's insurance provider. And so, you know, where this crossover between interests or issues that are of a public interest and also of a private matter, whether it's truly a use of office for that attorney, subject to professional responsibility rules, of course, as Commissioner Hollister is a subject matter expert in, you know, subject so long as there's no conflict, you know, I do struggle with this area where there's, you know, this gray area, and I think this case has, you know, matters of that. That being said, you know, I do think that a further investigation is needed just so that we can get all the facts out on the record and be able to really examine that gray area that I'm talking about. So, so appreciate Commissioner Hollister's, you know, questions. I think they're very, very enlightening. But the mere fact that there, even if there was an attorney-client, you know, relationship formed with that general counsel, I'm still not convinced that that's a use of office violation for the reasons I just said. So, thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Commissioner O'Day. Commissioner Fiscom.
Mr. Chair, thank you. As will be obvious in a moment, my question is going to be far less precise than either Commissioner Hollister or Commissioner O'Day. I simply wanted to suggest, Mr. Chair, that we provide Ms. Gould a general chance to make comments in response to Ms. Angeli's comments. Ms. Gould, I don't know if you had anything general to say in response to what you've heard. If not, that's okay, but I just want to make sure you had that opportunity if you wanted to seize it.
Well, I did the preliminary review investigation, and my executive director approved it, and the attorney approved it. So, at this stage, preliminary review is such a short period that we are tasked with finding if there's cause, as you defined cause, as you read it from our statute, but substantial objective basis to believe that a violation may have occurred is pretty low bar, and so at this stage, you know, I recommended that there's enough there to warrant further investigation. Now, that doesn't mean that there's going to be a violation at the end of an investigation. It just means I don't have enough information at this point. So that's the basis for the recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I would just add a perspective of, you've heard me and others add this before, but if we were to move to a full investigation, that does not connote that we think there has been a violation. It is only a commitment to do some more investigative work, after which we'll make that final decision as a commission. So there's often a confusion about that, especially in sometimes high-profile cases. A move to an investigation, if we choose to do that in some moments, does not constitute our decision that there has, in fact, been a violation. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Fiscom. We'll go in the order of hands raised, which will be Commissioner Hollister, then Commissioner Lindsay. Commissioner Hollister.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to state that I agree wholeheartedly with Commissioner O'Day's comments, and I agree that it is incredibly difficult in a case like this to determine whether whose interest was at stake. And for me, that is the core issue that, you know, I'm going to be deliberating about. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Hollister. Commissioner Lindsay.
Yeah, so Investigator Gold, I guess I could have a question as to why Ms. Goss, the OSU General Counsel, was not interviewed prior to this recommendation. I guess I'm just wondering procedurally why she was not interviewed prior to this report, instead waiting to do it until if we were to move forward or not.
Yeah, I just didn't have the time, and I wanted to get documents before I talked to Ms. Goss. I assumed that there may be some attorney-client invocation there or privilege matters, so I wanted to get the information I could during preliminary review. And we don't have subpoena power until we move into investigation, so I couldn't subpoena a deposition or any records during preliminary review, so that's why.
All right. Okay, thank you. Well, just to respond to some of the comments here, I think that Ms. Angeli makes very convincing arguments legally, especially and what Commissioner Hollister says. Yeah, there's attorney-client relationships, but in what capacity? Right, we're all wearing our hats as commissioners today, not individual personal hats, and so that needs to be carefully identified. But I think these arguments of no financial gain, fully public, no legal services, those are compelling and persuasive arguments. But the I think the question that changed my mind was Commissioner Sosa's question as to whether the general counsel had been talked to yet. We haven't heard her side of the story yet. So I think I'm inclined to proceed forward just to hear her side of the story. That's all I got to say.
Thank you, Commissioner Lindsay. Any other questions for the investigators from commissioners?
This is Commissioner Sortoon. I can't figure out how to raise my hand with the emoji. Sorry.
No, thank you, Commissioner Sortoon.
Thank you. I think this is a question for Ms. Gould or maybe our executive director. One of the things that Ms. Angeli said that struck a chord with me is the fact that the general counsel in that role will obviously be asked to provide information regarding public officials pretty regularly in their job. And it concerns me that the impact of providing information about a public official may require that public official, I mean, there may be a finding that public official got some benefit of it. But it strikes me that she is just doing her job here in responding to a peer university request. And so the inquiry, if we were to move into investigation, is truly whether this public official is getting some sort of a financial benefit. Can you talk about where the line is here? Because I am concerned about the implications of finding that a general counsel who is providing information about a public official could somehow cause that official to be sideways with the ethics rules. And I just need a better understanding of where the line is.
Well, I'll start and then the executive director can add something. My feeling is that we only have jurisdiction over public officials. So our only jurisdiction here, the complaint was against former President Alexander. So I was looking at his actions and his knowledge much more than the other side. And it struck me that Ms. Angeli said that there was no, that I kind of leapt to conclusions here, but I was just reading the email string between she and the investigators from Hush Blackwell, and it definitely shows that she, the attorney for OSU, had previously spoken to President Alexander about this investigation, because she says that. And she says he's happy to help, but would prefer to provide written answers to whatever questions you have. So do you want to send those questions along to me? So there had been, I mean, that's what I need to figure out, is what Dr. Alexander was availing himself of, in whether he knew that this was a, what kind of investigation this was from his prior university. And I, you know, I don't know those answers. When he got the questions, when Ms. Goff got the questions and transferred them to him, evidently, I assume she looked at these questions, but they're all personal questions to pertaining to his tenure at LSU. It has nothing to do with OSU. So I don't know whether it was public interest, private, but I know it was pertaining to his prior duties at LSU. So, I mean, that's all that I'm looking at, is his responsibilities under the ethics laws, not Ms. Goss's.
And I will tell you the reason my signature is on this report, recommending going forward, is I looked at it as it wasn't just providing documents. I understand. I think Commissioner Sortoon and others are right that general counsels for many organizations are going to send information forward. But in here, it sounds like there was discussion and decisions made on, okay, we're going to do it, but we're only going to do it in writing. We're not going to do it, you know, verbally over the phone. And so that's what I was looking at. It wasn't the actual documents going forward. It was the advice, the legal advice that was given to former President Alexander on how to respond to LSU's questions. And so I think that Commissioner Sortoon's right. I think many public counsels are going to be asked to provide documentation, disciplinary actions, whatever that is, that they can bring forward. But here it was actually the advice on how to respond to LSU's the group that the LSU hired for this investigation. And it looked like to me it was legal advice. And like I said, I also came to the conclusion, look at those emails, that there seemed to be some communication between OSU's attorney and former President Alexander on how that response was going to take place. And like I say, there was a decision made to do it in writing as opposed to a deposition, telephone interview, whatever else that you might have.
Thank you for that, Executive Director Burson. Now, Commissioner Lindsay, you had your hand up, or was that from the previous question? Okay, and then we'll move over then to Commissioner O'Day. He's the next one on the list.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Burson, for that explanation. I also appreciate Commissioner Sortoon's question. I just want to kind of tease this out a little bit to help illustrate, you know, some of the points I was making earlier, which I think, again, are present here. You know, where the mere getting of legal advice from a general counsel, I don't think in and of itself would necessarily give rise to an ethics violation, unless that advice was purely in that public official's interest and not in the interest of the public body. I can give an example, you know, in one which we're all familiar, and that is ethics. Regularly, public officials will go to their general counsel and ask for advice on whether a certain course of conduct is compliant with Oregon ethics laws. Now, we all know that ethics violations are personal to that official. It doesn't accrue to the public body. And so what should that public general counsel do in that situation? Should they say, I'm sorry, I can't advise you because ethics are personal to you, and instead you need to go seek private counsel? I can tell you practically that doesn't happen. And the reason why that general counsel gives that advice is because it's in that public's body best interest to ensure that the actions of that public official are legal and ethical. And so for me, this case really comes down to, do we have a similar situation here? And I don't think we have enough facts to be able to ascertain that. So again, that's why I'm supportive in going forward with the investigation. But for me, that's really the critical issue. Not whether the president received legal advice from the general counsel that might have affected him personally, but whether that was in such a way that you benefited only that president, and that there wasn't a larger public interest that the university had in this matter. And I see Executive Director Person, you've got your.
I see that.
Sure,
that's impressive.
Sure, you probably have something to say with regard to all that, but and I look forward to hearing it.
Thank you for that, Commissioner O'Day. We'll go to Executive Director Burson, then over to Commissioner Hollister.
Sorry about that, Commissioner Hollister, but I might forget if I wait just a little bit. But so I agree with Commissioner O'Day in what he said, in anything that's kind of prospective, and actually the commission is set up that way. You know, if people, they come to us for advice on actions they may take in the future that may come in contrast with the ethics laws. But what I looked at here was, is this was advice on things that happened in Mr. Alexander's past, what happened at LSU. And so it's something that, like, this agency wouldn't give advice on. We won't give advice on things that have already happened. So if you actually did go to your general counsel and said, you know, what are the ethical implications of the actions I've already done? I mean, I'm sure that counsel would say, sorry, that bell's rung. Favorite advice. I think, on the other hand, what Commissioner O'Day said, if you go to your general counsel and say, I'm looking at doing this, is there any implications with the ethics laws? I think it's more than appropriate for somebody to give them that advice. But in this case, it's something that already happened that we're getting legal advice on. Or we don't know that yet, but that's what we're looking to investigate.
Okay. Thank you for that. Commissioner Hollister.
Thank you. And I'm always happy to defer to our executive director for the record. So I just wanted to agree with wholeheartedly with Commissioner O'Day's statements just now. And I'm not sure that the bright line described by Executive Director person necessarily exists in practice. I do think that past behavior by public officials could have a very significant impact on a public body, and so it's not uncommon for folks to come and share instances in which they may have not technically complied, and in those instances, you know, the general counsel may want to know about that, in part because if, you know, failure to comply could give rise to sort of challenges to the public body's actions, and so the in-house general counsel might need to take, you know, to sort of take action to protect the public body. In this instance, I guess what I'm having trouble with, and maybe I'll share this with staff, is that it involved a prior employment that was not, I mean, it was advice about something that occurred before Dr. Alexander assumed the role of president. Mm-hmm. And because of that, it's harder to sort of reconcile the public interest in this matter. And so that's what I'm struggling with, and I feel like that is, you know, a key question for development, and you know, based on the conversation up to this point, I do think further development of the record is necessary.
Did you want to expand on
thank
that?
You.
Or no? Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Hollister. Commissioner Sosa.
Thank you, Chair. I think we've had an excellent and robust discussion on this matter, and I think we've given a lot for our investigator to think about, but I think that obviously, as you've heard in the discussions, there are enough questions out there in regard to Ms. Gose's role and the breadth of her services, her dealings with Dr. Alexander, that I'm going to make a motion that we proceed with a full investigation on this case.
Thank you, Commissioner Sosa. Any discussion on the motion?
Chair, you might want to call on Angeli, who had earlier wanted to speak.
Oh, yes.
Totally up to you.
Yes, my apologies. Ms. Angeli, before we'll let you jump in before we move forward with discussion on the motion that is on the table.
Thank you so much. I think it's largely moot, but I agree with you that it's not a super high bar, the definition of cause, but it does require a substantial objective basis for believing an offense occurred. And here, I don't think that is there. There may be questions about Ms. Gose's role, but I think there's just no evidence in the record that she provided some sort of personal benefit. And I think presumptively, when you're dealing with a general counsel in an organization, the in-house counsel is presumptively representing her client, the university. And I can't frankly imagine what legal advice he would need regarding a job that he had left where he no longer had a relationship and no compensation due there. And so the issue, I think, for both of them was, well, if this could have implications for OSU, you know, Ms. Goes needs to be in the loop because she may have to advise OSU. There's no evidence that he got some benefit from her on this. And I don't think that given that statutory standard, that speculation is sufficient, because if this does go forward, it will have continued costs for him as an individual. And so I think that standard should be taken seriously, and this is not costless simply to look further. And if there was insufficient investigation prior to your convening here today that would allow you to discern that substantial objective basis for believing an offense or violation had occurred, I think that then the balance of interest here has to tip in favor of not going forward. You can't just give a benefit of the doubt to evidence that simply does not exist in the record and say, well, there might be something there. I think that defies the standard.
Okay.
So respectfully, I appreciate y'all are having, I think, such clearly well-intended discussion about this and thoughtful discussion about that, and I appreciate that, but I do want to highlight the interests of the individual here who's going to have to keep paying legal fees when I don't think this standard is met.
Thank you for those comments, Ms. Angeli. We have a motion on the table. Any discussion on the motion, starting with Commissioner Lindsay?
Yeah, I think Ms. Angeli has a compelling argument there. I previously said I was inclined to support proceeding forward because we had not heard from the general counsel. I think all attempts should have been made to have at least attempted it with her prior to recommending that we proceed with this. Just procedurally, if there's possible other evidence out there, and that's the only reason why I'm proceeding, it just doesn't sit right with me. So for that reason, I'm going to oppose this motion. Just wanted to explain why.
Thank you, Commissioner Lindsay. Any other discussion on the motion?
Call for the question.
Seeing none, a roll call vote.
Commissioner Edwards?
Aye.
Commissioner Fiskum?
Aye.
Commissioner Hollister?
Aye.
Commissioner Lindsay?
Nay.
Commissioner O'Day?
Aye.
Commissioner Sartoon?
Aye.
Commissioner Sosa?
Aye.
Commissioner Starr?
Nay.
That was a nay.
Yes.
And Chair Mason?
Aye.
Motion passes. 7-2.
Thank you for joining us, Ms. Angeli. Our staff will be in touch. Thank you. On that note, we're going to take a quick 10-minute break.
Yeah.
Okay. I need to go over here.
Bio break, as they call it.
We do have the next one.